there's a massive challenge for us here. You look at Galatians superficially, and as I used to do, you just think, okay, well, I'm not tempted to get circumcised, so this has got nothing to say to me. But actually, as soon as you've seen that the foil for Paul's justification language is the entire infrastructure of pagan thought, basically what he's saying is that every single part of that worldly set of assumptions must fall. You've got to be willing to accept that submissive posture, and every single part of you has got to be kind of transformed by the Spirit to be orientated towards him.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the CPT Podcast. I'm Zach Wagner. Today we welcome back to the show CPT fellow Neil Martin, who we had on earlier this year. And the occasion for our conversation this time is the release of his new book, Galatians Reconsidered, Jews, Gentiles, and Justification in the First and the 21st Century. Neil is a pastor at a Presbyterian church in Oxford, England, and also serves as a lecturer at Keble College in Oxford in the New Testament faculty. And we're going to jump into our conversation with Neil, who at the time of our recording was live at SBL right now.
Neil Martin, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
It's good to see you. It's good to see you. You're normally based on the other side of the Atlantic, but you're in our neck of the woods. Well, sort of. I'm in Indianapolis right now. You're not exactly in Indianapolis, but you are in North America. Where are you, brother?
I'm in snowy Denver right now. Yeah,
outside. Reporting live.
Reporting
live from SBL.
I can give you that little weather report from SBL. No outside the window. And we used to live in Grand Rapids for a while, and so it's making me feel like I need to see the snow coming down outside the window.
That's right. I remember living in Cambridge, and there was a fresh powdering one time, right, with about a half an inch of snow. It shut the entire country down for like 2 days. Yeah. It was so great.
We're living the opposite reality now, because we raised our kids in Grand Rapids, where you get 90 inches of snow every winter.
Right.
But when it snows in England, they look at the flakes coming down. It's like, look out the window, like, nah, that's not going to cut it. No. Occasionally, they make a little snowman that's about 6 inches tall, just to kind of ironically express that they would much rather be back in the Midwest.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna completely geek out today on something that is precious to the three of us, which is Pauline studies and the Apostle Paul. Neil, you are an official Galatians scholar, and you've got a new book that's just come out. I mean, we're talking. It's still warm. It just is so hot off the press.
That's right. Yep.
Height of your powers, Neil.
Seriously. So we're excited to kind of get into that and just hear more about your research and writing on Paul, and use this conversation not only to connect with you on all of your research, but also just the state of play in Pauline studies. This is Zach, you're in the thick of this in your doctoral work. You're up to speed on all this. I used to be up to speed on all of this and now I'm completely rusty. So this is going to be educational.
Well, Todd, I'm not sure if anyone ever feels up to speed on Paul.
Well,
there's just endless stuff being published. So
yeah, fair enough. Well, why don't we start, Neil, with your research, and talk to us about your doctoral research thesis, and then this book that's just come out, and kind of connect the line there for us, and your reading of Paul. Yeah. And then Zach and I will no doubt want to kind of riff a little bit on all of that and situate what you're doing in the larger Pauline studies movement. I think that'd be a great way to start. So just talk to us about your thesis, which you published, and then this most recent book, and connect the dots for us in your own research and how you think about the Apostle Paul.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, in my mind, that the dots are really easy to connect. I always hoped to write the book that I've just done. And I had a fun interaction with my supervisor, Marcus Botmuel, about this. And I said to him when the new book came out, look, this is the book I was trying to write all those years, and you were trying to stop me. And I'm grateful for all of those years of being encouraged to really focus on actually doing the hard work of really thoroughly kind of mastering a particular field. But also that the passion that drove me through it was that I felt that was something here that was really valuable for the church.
Yes.
Now it's kind of the best of both worlds. And I feel so blessed to have had the opportunity to do that, to do an academic book, which is, 50% footnotes. And, it's something which has all of that technical weight to it. But then to come back and say, so what? Like, why is that?
Yes.
The new book is really, it gives... What I've tried to do, it's not an abridgment of the thesis. It's a complete rewrite. It's argued in quite a different way. I've tried to do it so it reads almost like a whodunit. So the chapters are short. I'm chasing an interesting... It starts like this kind of noodly little nuance, an oddity, something that doesn't fit, a loose thread within, I guess, conventional readings of Galatians. But it blows out into something which is much more exciting. But why is Paul even doing what he's doing? And what do we think he means by some of his kind of major categories? And I end in the basic message of the book in some ways is that, I playfully kind of subtitled it, Everybody's Right About Galatians. The thought is that actually the historic reading of justification really is what Paul is trying to say. But maybe he's trying to say it in a way that's slightly unexpected, if you really understand what's going on in the background to the letter. And so that's the adventure that I've kind of gone on. And then the new book is really, it's a privilege of sharing that adventure with people. And then, as I said, the latter part of it, I think what it's done for me, is it bad to confess that in the past Galatians was a bit of a dead letter to me, I must say? I used to read it and just think, well, I'm glad that Paul was sorting out all of these issues about people wanting to get circumcised, but that's never really been my temptation.
Right.
So, there are other parts of the New Testament that probably should have priority for me. But actually, shame on me, I really didn't realize what a potent prophetic text
for
today. I think it's really hitting issues which are really relevant for current church culture. Mm-hmm. So as someone who's kind of this, in this pastor theologian place, it's for me almost the ideal kind of section of God's word to be working with, because it really requires a lot of you as a scholar to be able to get to the bottom of what's going on. Then it's also giving all sorts of opportunities to bring it into the life of God's people in the present. So that's kind of what the project is there to do.
Zach, my heart feels strangely warm with everything.
Yeah, I know. We've been getting a lot of strangely,
I've got a tear in my eye. This is strangely so warm
in recent conversations. This is great.
But I found myself in the kind of from 2009 through to 2012 in a situation where I was running around with some biblical scholars and was encouraged to, get stuck into some of these questions. And the place where the lights kind of came on for me, or where the intrigue came from, was working through Galatians in a classroom with Jeff Weimer at Calvin Seminary in Grand Rapids.
Nice.
And just working through the letter and coming to the place in Galatians 4, Galatians 4, 8, and 9, where Paul basically says to this group of pagans in Galatia who are being tempted to become more Jewish, and he says to them, how are you going back to something that you've done before? And for me, that was just like, what? Like, what do you mean going back to something that you've done before? If you're recently converted pagans, there's no way you can go back to being Jewish. Yeah. And actually, as I've gone further on this, it's interesting to see, as you said, Zach, sometimes when you ask a good question, you realize that it's been asked in the past. And there's actually a pretty hilarious moment in Augustine's commentary on where he comes to this point, where he literally, whatever the Latin equivalent of is, but he basically does that and says, look, Paul, you can't say that's not possible to get circumcised twice. How can you say they're going back to something that they have familiarity with? So, and the way that it came for me, I think, the creative process is something where I think we need to just allow a lot of flexibility. Sometimes things will just emerge as a really slow burning thing. Sometimes they will just drop into your head as fully formed ideas. This one for me was more the latter. I think I had an instinct of where the solution to that question might lie. And we'll be talking about that a little bit as we get into the book later on. But the thing that was just really exciting as I started to work on it was to realize nobody was really asking that question. And that the question turns out to be absolutely pregnant through the entirety of the letter. Yeah. So the classic, one of the classic memory verses from Galatians would be Galatians 5:1. It's for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and don't let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. But when you read that, just ask yourself, Why does Paul use that word again?
Yes.
For freedom that Christ has set us free, stand firm then and don't let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. Like, what? It just makes so much better sense if that's not there. Yeah. And that language of them returning to something with which they already have prior experience turns out to be, I think, in every chapter of the letter.
Yes.
Go
on, Zach.
I was going to say, just to underscore, the reason this is so weird is, and there's broad agreement that the audience of Galatians or the auditors or the readers, whatever, original audiences, if not exclusively, at least very, very largely Gentile. So it's not like they grew up with the Torah. So this is why this is an interesting question, and I think it's such
an insightful question. And there's a superficial solution in there as well, which is interesting, but that when you get into it, you realize it doesn't work. So obviously there's a whole lot of speculation about where even these Galatian churches were. I think the burden of scholarship is moving pretty decisively now towards saying that these are southern Galatian congregation. So probably, you know, in the area that Paul touches on his first missionary journey, Pisidian, Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, that kind of place. And when you read about that in Acts, what you find is that Paul is going to synagogues in order to meet Jews and tell them that their Jewish Messiah has come. And that part of it doesn't go so well. But he meets their God-fearers, Gentiles who are part of these communities, and has the opportunity to share the gospel with them. So that's, if you take that as the back, it's not at all inconceivable that you've got former God-fearers floating around in this Galatian congregation. And some people will say, oh, well, there's your answer. So they're returning to Judaism in the sense that they used to be part of these Jewish communities. But the problem with that, as soon as you ask yourself, what would it have been like to be a God-fearer in first century Asia Minor? What being a God-fearer means is it means adding a Jewish component to your existing portfolio of religious interests. And this kind of begins to show why Galatians is so contemporary. Because today everything is about having personal portfolios of interests, right? You know, I get a little bit of Jesus, I get a little bit of kind of self-help, you know, philosophy, I get a little bit of that, a little bit of that, and I put it together into my own personal kind of composition.
Neo-paganism.
And so I guess the issue that you've got, as soon as you see that Paul thinks that by getting circumcised, these guys are going back to something that they've done before, that fit just doesn't fit. Because getting circumcised is like the absolute quintessential step of exclusive commitment to the God of Israel. That's saying, I no longer want to be classed as a pagan. I want to be a former pagan, as I think Paula Fredrickson would call it. I want to have left that behind. And so once you've realized that, you have to start looking for a slightly more nuanced perspective on what this going back might have entailed. And even if you did go with that whole God-fearer thing, I mean, the stuff that Paul says is just, frankly, outrageous, isn't it? If you read it, he says to them, formerly when you did not know God, you were slaves to those who by nature are not God. So this is idolatry, right? Galatians 4:8. He may be even having a little bit of a dig at the Roman emperor here, you know, someone who calls himself a God, but who isn't. And then Paul says, but now that you know God, or rather are known by God, how is it you're returning back to those weak and miserable stoicheia? So the issue with it is, if you really believe that actually what they're doing is returning to something like God-fearing, he's equating Jewish worship with idol worship. And that's like, that's astonishingly bold. And actually, it's interesting, you see some of the commentators do go that way, and it leads you pretty much directly to Marcionism.
I was going to say, there's a long Christian tradition going back quite a long way of... I mean, Christian anti-Semitism is really, if you want to get down to it, a disdain for the Torah, a disdain for Jewish identity, and the kind of innovation that Paul was offering, so the interpretation goes, was a break from this kind of godless work righteousness that was either had calcified in Judaism or something like that. So it's not like no one has ever read Galatians that way. That's actually a way many people have read Galatians.
And actually kind of cue the old perspective in some ways.
Exactly.
A simplistic way of framing the old perspective would be to say that Paul's theology of grace and works is underneath it presenting Christianity, Paul's Christianity as the grace part and Judaism as the works part of it. And so it's essentially kind of positioning Judaism. Paul's had this revelation that what he did before is essentially kind of intrinsically unavoidably bound up with works righteousness. And when he says in, you know, Galatians 1, he talks about, you've heard about my previous way of life in Judaism. Some people would read that as like, I've completely left that behind. Yep. And that feels like a neat little solution tied up with a bow, until you just read on a couple of paragraphs and you hear that Paul shares the right hand of fellowship with law-observant Jewish Christians like James, you know, and where you read in Acts that Paul circumcises Timothy, that he's happy in Acts 21 to, you know, do legally observant things in the temple in Jerusalem, that he's had the 40 lashes minus one, which is synagogue discipline, right? So he's still happy to be under, you know,
he's submitted to Jewish discipline.
Yeah. So immediately it gets you into this. We have a problem here. We have an inconsistency.
We have a problem.
Actually, I want to show you it goes even bigger than what we've just done, but it gets you right into the heart of what does Paul even mean by this contrast between faith and works.
Can I just make a comment, Neil, and would love to hear you reflect on this, and Zach as well. When you just said, you know, Todd, you got in the noodly thing and it blows out was the language you used. That's, I think, something you don't appreciate from the outside looking in on what happens when you do a doctoral thesis or when you do that level of research. I think the impression from the outside would be you get so narrow on something so tedious and small that it's so disconnected from everything else. Nobody cares. And what's the point? When in fact, what is my experience and the experience of other people, and Neil, you're giving testimony to this morning, is as you get really geek out on something very tedious and small, use your language, it blows out into everything, you might say. It like connects to everything. You're like, wow, this connects to everything. Yeah. That experience and that, and part of what I want to tag on to this is why when folks ask me like, should I go do a PhD? This is one of the reasons by kind of drilling down super deep underneath the earth's core, so to speak, you connect with everything. Yeah.
And I think I would say from my own experience with that, I think that that does mean that you just need to choose carefully and also have good people around you when you're making your initial kind of forays into this. I agree. We both have the same story here. And my sense of Zach's project as well is that it's going to kind of work out.
Yes, for sure.
But not all PhDs work out that way. I remember when I sat down with, had the privilege of sitting down with Doug Moo before I actually kind of put in my PhD application. And he cautioned me and he said, look, Neil, the process of doing a PhD is, you know, learning more and more about less and less until you know everything about nothing. It's kind of a nice little aphorism. But there's a danger there, isn't it? If you decide that you want to do as a PhD topic some kind of really noodly word study on, you know, exactly why does Paul, you know, what's the significance of the, you know, I don't know, the genitive ending of some weird obscure word in Paul and every other possible source, you might end up basically, you know, getting a PhD and having spent 3 years in a library, but literally have nothing to say. So I think choosing a project which actually has the kind of potential that we're talking about, there's a bit of an art to that. It doesn't just happen automatically.
Yes.
So I think taking time to get some counsel, think about what the issues that your topic might inform at the start is really wise. And also as you go along in a project, it's not just you decide at the start and you go for it. All three of us know that actually when you're doing a doctorate, as you're working with your advisor and with other people within the academic community where you study, there will be opportunities to tip it towards something which is maybe more purely a scholarly interest, or to tip it towards something where you think it's actually got potential to really
fabulous.
Help. That's really yes. Sometimes I think as an evangelical, you will have to actually be prepared to push for the latter.
Yes. Say, no,
I don't want this just to become a study of obscure second century, you know, pseudepigrapha. I want to study Galatians and that's the way it's going to be, or I want to study X or Y. So I think
there's
some intentionality that's required to actually deliver on what you've just said.
Yep. Neil, and I wonder, I'm just thinking of, that's super helpful what you just said, like not every thesis does, can get obscure. I remember Haithman telling the story of somebody who went and studied in Germany like he did, and The thesis he was handed by his supervisor was, I think, about precious stones in the Bible. Yeah. And he had to research everything about precious stones in the Bible for 3 years and write the whole thing up in German. Like, I don't know about that. But I wonder, Neil, and this is getting us into, you know, we're all biblical studies people here. We're not theology people. But I wonder, I'm looking back on my own experience, I'm thinking, my interest has always been in biblical studies, but the biblical studies was really a way of, like, a window in on Christian theology for me. Like, yeah. Paul and the law and the history of Christianity and Israel and the church and all, those are deep theological questions that have profound ethical implications. And so my exegesis as a New Testament scholar was always animated by these theological questions. And I wonder, Neil, if that's something instructive for listeners or folks that are in this, in graduate study, thinking about doing a PhD, is what are the theological issues that are most interesting to you, most animating, and where do they touch down on New Testament or Old Testament texts? And sort of use that as a way in, right? So you don't get to some exegetical New Testament studies question that is sort of disconnected from anything of theological relevance. Does that resonate, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that is about having a lively interaction with God's word yourself.
Yes. You know,
if the Bible is something which is a living kind of source of light and also of challenge and confusion and insight in your own walk, that it's going to be harder to end up with something which is kind of completely disconnected.
Yeah.
I think in my own, I mean, I just resonate with what you said, absolutely, in that original moment of kind of like, wow, there's something here in Galatians for me. The reason why it was a wow is I thought to myself, here's a way to actually speak about what Christians have always spoken about in terms of justification, the kind of that fundamental kind of that part of what Paul wants to say about what Jesus accomplishes. Here's a way to speak about it, which actually doesn't just say, we've always said it, so it's true, but actually finds it in the text in a new way. So I suppose I felt, maybe this will be a slightly clumsy way of saying what I'm going to say, but I always found it kind of slightly frustrating as I looked on from the periphery of this debate about the new perspective as was. I would hear people say, on the one hand, you would get this argument, look, actually, in the first century, there's not that much evidence of hyper-legalistic works righteousness Judaism. Jews don't seem to think or write like that. They seem to write like they're people who've received blessings from God and become children. You know, they are children of Abraham. This is God's initiative towards them, and then they respond faithfully with obedience. And so that was kind of one group.
Enter Simon Gathracol.
Yeah. And we could talk a little bit about that. But it felt to me, and this is going to be the clumsy bit, but it felt to me the voices I was hearing as Christians tried to respond to that, certainly conservative voices, they basically seemed to be saying, well, I guess there were loads of legalistic Jews out there, but we just haven't found them yet. Or they didn't write down what they said, but they must have been there because we've always believed that. And that's good enough.
Yep.
And for me, that just felt so weak. That felt like such a kind of a thin basis on which to stand something which is absolutely axiomatic to our Christian practice. And so what was exciting about the project was a way to say, actually, I really do think that what Paul is doing when he talks about justification is he is talking about how God has dealt with our fundamental estrangement from him, which is a very kind of reformed historic way of looking
Romans at what's 1-4 going on there. Stuff.
But the way that I could see of doing it in Galatians was actually absolutely embracing what I was reading about the, you know, the first century landscape for Jewish thought.
Marvelous.
And so that's why it was exciting. I could see a way for us to celebrate and dance on the things which I think have been and always, you know, hopefully always will be central to our Christian convictions, but to do it in a way that was actually not just kind of hoping it was true, even though you couldn't necessarily find it in the evidence, but to actually build it right up out of the evidence.
Can I just affirm that same? My research and thesis has a similar sort of punchline as well, because I, you know, as a 20, 21 year old, I was not satisfied with a kind of strong law-gospel contrast and a Lutheran reading of these things, which dispenses with, you might say, the third use of the law in a kind of real, the necessity of obedience in the Christian life. And in particularly in the North American evangelical scene, that's an issue, right? And expressions in dispensational Christianity and in certain kinds of Lutheran expressions of Christianity. So you might say, and this is overly simplistic, but you might say, I was kind of coming at it from a more reformed way of thinking about the law's relationship to the gospel and so on, and its ongoing relevance and role in the life of the Christian. And got to that punchline, Neil, through a wholly different sort of approach to the argument of Galatians. But it was, you know, there was this sort of animating pastoral burden that was driving it. That's interesting. That's interesting. You're resonating with that.
So I guess the sum of that is, like, if Scripture is pastoring us, then our reaction to it will be, how can it pastor us and pastor others? And so out of that comes these more outward focused, more pastorally motivated project.
Hey everybody, I hope that you are enjoying your holiday season so far. Just a quick note to draw to your attention that we here at the CPT are a nonprofit organization, and like just about all nonprofits, this time of year we are focusing on our fundraising efforts to continue to sustain, grow, and expand our ministry as the Lord would prosper us. And we are asking if you have enjoyed this podcast or appreciate the ministry and mission of the CPT to consider donating to support the ministry. You can do that by going to pastortheologians.com/donate. We have a lot of new and exciting stuff planned for 2023. Some good news about a grant application that we're excited to share more with you about in the near future. Thank you for considering this. And once again, a happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and a happy new year to all of you. Can I ask maybe if we can try, because we've been, I hope this has been helpful, but I fear that we're just kind of geeking out, and I want to zoom out a little bit for some listeners and ask Neil for you to do something perhaps a little ambitious, which is to kind of like summarize the 500-year history of Protestant scholarship on the Epistle of Galatians. From kind of Martin Luther to the present, because I think that kind of narrative will help situate what both of you have been talking about, the kind of law-gospel contrast for you, Todd, and your research, but then also this question of what is the situation that Paul is speaking to relative to the Galatian auditors, readers. So, start with Luther. I mean, we've already talked about this, Neil, kind of carry us forward.
Yeah, in England, that's what we call a hospital pass, but I will attempt to receive that. I mean, I think that's like, isn't it, that we're able to kind of sketch where do we stand within the larger story. So although it's a big question, I think it's a really important question. And often I think we stumble because we don't see where we are in the larger historical narrative.
Yes.
So, I mean, we're all so obviously massively indebted to the Reformation, aren't we? And that as we look back, you know, that work of recovery that we see there in terms of trying to figure out what actually are the essentials is something to which we're massively indebted. And so Luther, part of his, it's a profoundly personal journey for him, but the recovery that he's going on is basically seeing that actually, personally, partly he sees that this is of massive personal relevance, you know, that what he's reading in Paul is actually something which is talking about his own interaction with God. And then he also wants to recover this idea, you know, that it's central to him that human beings are estranged from God and that God has overcome that from his own side, that it's God's work, God has stepped towards us, and Christ is the way that he's done it. God has made a way that we can't make. It's kind of like Luther rediscovers almost the, it's a biblical theological theme going all the way back to Genesis, isn't it? If you think about what's happening with Babel and Abraham, and in Babel, it's an attempt to kind of claim the heavens, to build a tower, to get back to the place that we come from. And the Abraham story is to say, no, you can't build a name for yourself. God comes to you. God comes down. He makes a way. He forgives. He finds a way to bear your burden, to pay your debt. And that's Luther's grand rediscovery. I guess the problem with it is that the way that he did it was partly, and this has been highlighted by, you know, people like N.T. Wright very effectively, is that he reads his own situation back into the text. So that breakthrough of kind of, you know, I felt so guilty and helpless, and then I realized that actually God had come to kind of meet my need. Luther pastes that back onto Paul and says, Paul must have felt so, you know, ungodly and helpless as a Jew. And then suddenly Christ comes and the lights go on. So immediately he positions Judaism and Paul's past in Judaism as kind of the foil to this massive conversion moment. And so then that, as you work your way through the scholarship, I suppose, you know, leaping over the centuries here, a really important moment to touch down will be with F.C. Bauer in 19th century Germany. I've heard it said that all Christian theology from that point forward is just footnotes to F.C. Bauer. I think that that's a slight exaggeration.
We're still kind of working on that.
We're still working our way out of
the hole.
Yeah. You know, Bauer basically takes that Lutheran program and just kind of absolutely dials everything up. He takes the amplifier and runs all of the dials up to 11 and basically wants to say, look, what's happening with Paul is a decisive break with Judaism. He sees actually a fracture within the Christian community.
Yeah.
Paul breaks away from Peter, James, and John.
From the synoptic tradition in certain ways as well.
Yeah. And he sees it, he frames it in terms of a radical innovation from Paul, you know, like a leaving behind of all of the Jewish tradition. So again, it's got that quasi kind of Marcionistic thing about it. And that then is the place where we start to, I mean, Galatians was central for Luther. He called Galatians his Katie von Bora. So he said he had destroyed it, his nearest and dearest as an epistle. But Bauer, again, Galatians is absolutely central for him.
Does Bauer, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Bauer coin Hauptbriefe?
Yeah.
Or, yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's so very interesting to think about what's going on there. You know, so we're used, aren't we? When I first started encountering this stuff, when you hear about this differentiation within the Pauline corpus, and say there are some books that are really Paul and some books that are kind of less Paul.
Ooh. Yeah, and Hauptbriefe, we should say Hauptbriefe means a set of primary letters.
Yeah.
In German, and that is this grouping that includes, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but Galatians, the first and second Corinthians, and Romans is it.
So those are his form
For Bauer, and those are the central Pauliest Pauling letters that Paul wrote. Maybe he wrote some other things, but also maybe he didn't. And Bauer is also the kind of height of critical scholarship that rejects authorship of certain epistles. So I think the centralizing of Galatians is another part thing that's going
on. We've all kind of been told, I think, that basically the way that that works, the way that you separate out the real Paul from the not so real Paul, is all to do with what language that he uses. You know, the vocabulary of Ephesians is different in some radical way from the vocabulary of Galatians, and therefore, you know, it's less Pauline. Actually, when you get right down into that, there's no real argument there. We just don't have enough actual words on the page to make that kind of statistical judgment.
Yeah.
And it's a small when you look at comparable things in the past, you can see, you know, there are all kinds of historical authors who've written things with very different vocabulary, and yet they were still written by the same person. The thing which drove it was that Bauer found in Galatians, Romans, and in the Corinthian letters, this theme of justification, which for him totally separated the Pauline vision from that historic Jewish vision. And so for him, that's what made them super, you know, the Hauptbriefe, the super Paul epistles.
Yes.
And then it relativized the other ones. And so it's interesting, is it the reason why we get this, we would say, you know, this is the beginning of kind of liberal critical scholarship in Paul in some ways. But actually the fundamental problem is that Bauer is too Lutheran. He's too reformed, you know, that he just values justification too much. And it's a warning for today, isn't it? You know, that, you know, if you absolutely camp on that and you don't value union with Christ and you don't value Christus Victor and all these other things, you can end up bent out of shape, you know, rather, you can end up undermining rather than reinforcing orthodoxy.
Yeah, there's a lovely, and this, Neil, we should have you back because there's a whole conversation that we could have around the theological significance of the shape of the canon of Scripture and the placement of Paul within it. And there is always this tension of, you know, of the core, like the center of your canon, right? The functional center of your canon. What are you prioritizing as you approach Scripture? And always these tensions. And Bauer, of course, does it in a very formal, famous way that is resonant with Lutheran theology and the Reformation tradition, right? But you might say we all are doing that in one way or another.
Well, I wonder, Neil, if we can keep it moving. Is Christopher Stendhal a good place to go next?
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe?
Yeah, so I think, you know, so we enter into the kind of middle 20th century with, bizarrely, with conservative and liberal threads in Pauline scholarship, both in some ways embracing the same set of assumptions.
Yeah.
There's a certain set of issues within Paul, which
justification at the center.
Judaism is the foil. You know, and then and they handle it in different ways. And then you start to get some kind of shaking in the ground. And I think Christa Stendhal is a good place to go. Basically, I think remembered for two things, particularly, although, you know, a great scholar across a whole range of different areas. But Christa Stendhal basically asked, look, is Paul really converted on the road to Damascus? And that's a massive question. You know, as you read about Paul's story in Galatians, he seems to see himself receiving something more like a prophetic commissioning. You know, Paul does say, you heard about my previous way of life in Judaism, but that sentence continues, how intensely I persecuted the church of God and tries to destroy it. The thing of which he repents seems to be his desire to wipe out these Jewish Messiah believers. But it doesn't seem to be a fundamental step away from Judaism, the thing. And then he talks about being set apart from his mother's womb, basically quoting words from Jeremiah to say, this is what it looked like to be to be called to announce a radical prophetic truth to God's people, in Paul's case, the coming of the Messiah. And then also within Stendhal, we just have this, he very, very helpfully just questions Luther's first move, I guess, of reading himself back into Paul, and says, look, Luther may have had this very introspective experience of, you know, what did it look like, for me as someone who's really experienced a weight of guilt to suddenly be set free by the discovery that God justifies. But when you come to Galatians, Paul seems to think the Jews have always known that God justifies by faith. You know, that's his argument with Abraham, isn't it? And actually that's going to become, I'm stealing my own thunder here, that becomes a really important part of my own work on it. So that's Stendhal. And then I think if that's the...
If I can just say one more thing on Stendhal. The other thing is this question of, you know, Luther felt really badly, striving really hard to keep God's law, quote unquote, and always felt like he was kind of falling short. And so the message of justification, you know, by grace through faith for Luther was a balm to his soul. Like, I don't have to be perfect.
Yeah.
But we actually don't quite see Paul, and I think this is the other key insight of Stendhal's famous essays on this, Paul doesn't talk that way. He actually seems to think that he kept the law pretty well. Thank you very much.
His very robust conscience.
Yes. So that's the other thing. Like, Paul doesn't seem to have this is the title of Stendhal's essay, The Introspective Conscience of the West. Paul doesn't seem to have an introspective conscience where he's torn up about the fact that he's not living as God wants him to live. He actually says that he is blameless according to the law, which kind of on this side of the Reformation, you're like, how on earth could anyone say such a thing?
Yeah. Although even that introduces some interesting complexities, doesn't it? When he says that in Philippians, Paul is definitely in horizontal mode, comparing himself peer to peer with other people who have similar claims. So is it equatable to his discussion in vertical mode, talking about how he stands before God? So I think that's
And you need to bring Romans 7, which no one knows what's going on in Romans 7. You need to bring Romans 7 into this conversation as well, which is always the thing that goes off in my head when I think about that kind of argument from Stendhal, is you got to wrestle that to the ground.
Yeah. I suppose they're kind of moving forward from there. If Stendhal kind of represents like the pre-tremor, the earthquake proper is Ed Sanders, You know, he's obviously, he makes a massive contribution and is, you know, big enough to say that he's standing on the shoulders of giants and doing it, particularly a lot of Jewish giants who have been saying throughout the 20th century and some even earlier that this Judaism as the, as a legalistic foil to Paul's vision of righteousness by faith just doesn't work. So I think that that's
E.P. Sanders, Paul and Palestinian Judaism, exactly. 1973.
Yeah. So it's an epoch making book within, yes. I think it's still the giant on the landscape of Pauline studies after 50 yes. years. Yes. But what it did, it basically blew a massive hole in the ground where our certainties about Judaism as a legalistic religion stood. Because he basically went back and pretty exhaustively went through all of the sources that he could find from first century and actually first century BC and AD, looking at Jewish material, and just didn't find the kind of axiomatic dependence on like, I'm justified in the sight of God because here's the way I keep the law. It just wasn't there. Now, admittedly, I think as with a lot of these polemicizing arguments, and we all need to look ourselves in the mirror here, you know, when we get into polemic mode, it's very easy not to be quite fair to the thing we're polemicizing against. Yes. And I'll basically make a maximalistic case saying there is no evidence whatsoever of Jewish works righteousness. And I think just from a purely anthropological perspective, that's a really, not a sustainable place to go. There is works righteousness, however you want to define that, in every human society, isn't there? It's a feature of human nature, and particularly humans in positions of authority, that once we get to those places, we tend to stand on our own authority and base our sense of standing on what we ourselves have achieved. So I don't think that we should be surprised at all to find works righteousness in the Gospels, you know, among Jewish leaders. But I think Sanders' insight is to say, but that's nothing particularly special about Judaism. That's something that you would just see anywhere. It doesn't stand out as the Jewish pattern of religion, to use the words that he used. And so I think basically where that leaves us, Sanders, if you can kind of imagine it, you look back to 1971, and hopefully now you can just see this vast kind of smoking crater in the ground where the certainties of Pauline biblical studies used to live. And I think a couple of things have happened in the 40 years subsequent to that. The one big project is basically the fill in the hole and pretend it never happened project, which is basically to try to say, oh, well, actually, if you really look carefully at all of these sources, what you find is that it really is there. It's just more subtle than we thought. And my sense is that work has contributed a massive amount to our discipline, but I'm not satisfied that they really undermined what Sanders had to say. So, and then the other way of approaching it, so there's the fill it all in and hope it just goes away. And then there's the build something different in the whole strategy. And this is where we enter the new perspective or the new perspectives on Paul. And I think pretty rapidly, and maybe sadly too rapidly, Jimmy Dunn and then Tom Wright kind of ran into the wreckage and just started building. And I think maybe we're at a moment now where people are beginning to look back and say, was that the right thing to build? Or was that exactly the right place in which to stick the foundations? Yeah. And so the thing that they created was basically to say, look, if you don't have Jewish legalism and works righteousness as the foil for Paul's talk about justification, what else? And the thing that they put in its place, and this is where I think the problem is something which is that they problematize Judaism a different way. So rather than saying Judaism is fundamentally all about works and earning your way to God, they say, and again, this is going to be crass, but Judaism is about ethnic identity and what you need to kind of demonstrate what outward signs of kind of conformity to that identity you need to display in order to show both God and man that you are on the team. And so it boils down to things like food, laws, festivals, circumcision. These are the kind of like the guide rails that show you what the community of children of Abraham look like and what the people who are outside the community are like in contrast. And for Paul, then the big issue is you don't have to express those things anymore in order to really be a son or daughter of Abraham. So that's basically where Dunn and Wright bring us.
Yeah. So the traditional Lutheran perspective is down on Judaism because Judaism is, well, reads Paul as being down on Judaism, perhaps is a better way to state that. Because Judaism is legalistic and shot through with works righteousness. And then the new perspective actually just kind of moves over the critique of Judaism to something else, is what I hear you saying, Neil. And I think
yeah, and it's right. A very, you know, that's a simplistic way of saying it.
It is, yeah. So you can nuance all of this, and this is speaking in generalizations. But the traditional perspective, Judaism bad because legalism, and then the new perspective, quote unquote, not so new anymore, but the new perspective, quote unquote, Judaism still bad, but because it's ethnocentric.
I think also it's worth just kind of picking up there to kind of bring the conversation back to Galatians in a way.
Yes,
one of the problems with that new perspective or those new perspectives, as soon as what you say that's wrong with Judaism is it's to do with how you express membership of the community, the problem, I think, becomes less evidently earth-shaking. You know, at least in the Lutheran perspective, this whole thing is how do you or don't you obtain reconciliation with your maker? You know, that's a vast existential question. And you can see why in a letter like Galatians, Paul would be blowing his top. Like, you know, and he does in Galatians. I mean, it's kind of funny. You know, it's by far the most extreme of Paul's letters.
It's as agitated as we see Paul.
Yeah, yeah. But as soon as you go down the new perspective road and you say, look, the problem here is, you know, we've got these Gentile Christians in Galatia who want to get circumcised. And Paul's saying that you don't have to do that anymore because Christ has come. The question that leaves me asking, like if I were pastoring this little set of churches, the first thing I would want to write to them is like, wow, like, well, let's talk about the wisdom of this, but the fact that you want to go as far as getting circumcised to express allegiance to this God, that's awesome. Like, you know, that's commitment. I'm so excited that you're really into this. So now let's talk about how to channel that enthusiasm well. But Paul doesn't do that at all. Like, to him, it's in. I mean, these are some of the boldest ones.
Have you been bewitched, you poor Galatians? What happened to you?
Yeah,
or cast a spell on your heads.
In Galatians 5:2, he says, "Mark my words. I tell you, I Paul tell you, that if you let yourselves be circumcised, Christ will be of no value to you at all." Like, that's explosive. That's fighting talk from Paul. And he puts his name to it. You know, he wants to say, look, this is the deal. So I think as soon as you go down that path, the upside for the Lutheran reading is it does at least give you a reason to see why Paul takes it all so seriously. But as soon as you start to build that alternative structure in the middle of the, you know, of the crater, you got problems actually just trying to make sense of the extremity of Paul's language. Mm. And that, I think, becomes a really important kind of litmus test for any reading of the letter. Can you read it in such a way that you can justify Paul's extremity? Why is he so worked up about this? Why does he see it as a salvation issue? And partly what I've tried to do is get to the point where you can fully do justice to that. You can allow Paul the full-throated warning that he wants to give, but while still trying to make sense of some of these tensions that on the one hand, you know, he seems to be really beating up on them for engaging with Judaism, but on the other hand, it's sharing the right hand of fellowship with law observant Jews as if there's no problem.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Neil, I'm glad we have this all recorded. That was a fantastic sort of overview of Pauline studies of the last 500 years. That's fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah, and we can do the stuff on the thesis. Can actually, it's a relatively simple idea, so it's not going to take
Give us the thesis, Neil.
So what is the answer? So we've spent a long time thinking about
that. Yeah, and maybe that cheeky subtitle of everybody's actually right about Galatians.
Yes.
Maybe kind of make peace with all this. And go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the place where all of this lands is just trying to actually put yourself in the position of the reader for a moment. And that requires a little bit of working into Paul's text itself. And then other places in the New Testament, and then also just complementing that with some wider knowledge of what's happening in the region. I mean, I read to you already Galatians 4:8, formerly when you did not know God, you were slaves to those who by nature are not God's. Paul is clearly aware that there's a religious life in the background of these people, that they have been devoted to idols. And it shouldn't surprise us in the slightest when we know something about what's going on in Southern Asia Minor at the time. Another interesting little reference point, if you are happy to see this as being something which is happening kind of along the route of the first missionary journey. Jump back to Acts 14, and you get that brilliant little incident in Lystra, you know, where Paul and Barnabas rock up and they heal this guy. And suddenly the whole town come out with like wreaths and they're sacrificing bulls and saying, these guys are Zeus and Hermes. Gives you a bit of a flavor of what's happening in the religious life of that community.
Yes.
And also, it's important to just unpick that a little bit. When I was younger, I used to read that as like, oh, it's a carnival. Like the gods have arrived. This is good news, you know, so let's have a party. But actually, that's not what's happening in that text at all. If you know where Lystra is on the ground, it's just down the road from a place called Tyana. Tyana is like the place in Greek mythology. You can read about this in Ovid's Metamorphoses, where Zeus and Hermes do actually visit the earth in human form on an occasion. And they go from city to city, from house to house, knocking on doors, and nobody will give them the time of day or entertain them. And they finally end up in the house of this elderly couple called Philemon and Baucis up on a mountainside. And it's this very, very kind of, you know, humble dwelling. And yet when Zeus and Hermes knock on the door in human form, they're welcomed in and they share a meal and then they reveal themselves. And what happens is, they then say, okay, well, you guys welcomed us, so you will survive. But everybody else is going to be annihilated in a flood. And this is the, you know, the Phrygian flood myth. But the thing which is really striking about that, if you think, like, what does it look like to be right with the gods in this world that Paul is engaging with? This is something where you absolutely have to just scratch the gods the way they want to be scratched.
Yes.
In order to avoid catastrophe. And that's a justification story. How can I be right with the gods? I need to play my cards right. I need to detect them when they arrive. I need to make sure I do the right thing. And then as you start to push into the archaeology of the region, you just see that's massively confirmed. And there's huge variety. You know, there are some people in Southern Asia Minor who really believe that you can actually make the gods do exactly what you want by making the right offerings, by giving the right prayers, by announcing the right curses. There are other people who have a much more minimal, this is probably more common, a much more minimal vision, which basically says, look, I have cards to play in the divine human game, and I better play them well, because if I don't, things will probably be worse. They don't have a very hopeful vision of, you know, how they can actually make everything right. But basically, you get this sense that in the first century, the religious kind of world that Paul is stepping into here is one which is, there are lots of things that you can do. There are rituals that you can perform. There are offerings that you can make. There are offerings that you can put before the gods in order to maximize the chances that you'll be blessed and minimize the chances that you'll be cursed. That's the kind of world that these people are in. So then what you've got to imagine, if you think about the actual situation in Galatia, so this is the world into which Paul has stepped with his gospel. I think we should assume that he knows this world well. Everything that we're told in Acts suggests that he's traveled extensively here. We hear that he knows the Lycaonian language. Well, that's an investment of time in the actual place. And so he knows, and actually in Galatians, you can see various echoes that he kind of has understood the local religious vocabulary and he can weave it into his argument. So let's assume that Paul knows what's going on. He arrives in this place, he teaches them the gospel of Jesus, and then he jets. And probably 18 months, 2 years later, we find him writing a letter reflecting on the fact that now some Jewish Christians have arrived. We don't know where they're from. So much ink has been spilt over who these people are and where they're from. The answer is we really don't know. All that we know is that basically these people are trying to encourage these, you know, Gentile converts to be more Jewish. And I just want to get us to ask, and this is kind of where the rubber hits the road, how would these Galatians have responded when enthusiastic Jewish Christian missionaries show up and say, keep the law, get circumcised, keep the feasts, be ritually pure? And my thesis is, and I just think that this is kind of obvious, is that they would have responded with exactly the same set of expectations for those sorts of behaviors that they had had bashed into them from their mother's knee. You know, if you have always heard that going to the temple, making your offerings, keeping all of the necessary rituals is a way to play your gods on side, they wouldn't have thought about the Jewish law in any different way, irrespective of what these Jewish Christian missionaries thought they were doing. And that's kind of the aha moment, because what it allows you to do is to say, whoever these people influencing them to be more Jewish were, whatever they thought the law achieved, whether they thought it was all works righteousness, frankly, I think that's unlikely, or even if they didn't, none of that matters. The issue is, how would the Galatians have reacted to it? Give them this infrastructure of laws to keep, and what's going to happen is that they're going to keep those laws with pagan expectations, because that's what they have habituated into them. They're not going to keep them with the same kind of expectations that the Jews who brought them had, because that's totally alien to them. And so this is why Paul can say you're going back to something that you've done before. He's not actually saying circumcision is bad, that the law is bad, that the law is cursed in some way. What he's trying to say is that when you Gentile keep it, you keep it like a pagan. You think it's accomplishing what pagans think religious laws accomplish. And that's the reason why it's problematic. So,
beautiful.
Yeah. So the thing which is really exciting about this is that when you've seen that, it just fits some of the most angular details of the letter.
Yes.
So how can Paul say the words that I read? I tell you that if you let yourselves be circumcised, Christ will be of no value to you at all. The issue there is all about the you. If you let yourself be circumcised with your particular background and your expectations, you are going to see this thing as a way to actually, it's going to be this lasting thing between you and God. Look at this incredible risk I took, this pain I experienced in order to express devotion to you. Now what's coming back? That's the pagan mentality. And that, it totally does. It means Christ will be of no value to you at all. But it also means that you can read with integrity the totally mind-blowing verse that happens just four verses later in Galatians 5:6. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision has any value. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Do you see that? So it's not that circumcision itself is the problem. It's who is getting circumcised. And so it then allows you to come to, I mean, I think for me, this is a really exciting exegetical moment. When you come back to Galatians 2:15 and 16, which hopefully we all know, and which is like the one of the crown jewels of our gospel inheritance, isn't it? Paul turns to Peter and says, we who are Jews by birth and not sinful Gentiles know that a person is not justified by the works of the law, but by faith in Jesus Christ. And we have kind of been, we've all been sold that through the years as being, here's a place where Paul draws out a fundamental contrast between two schools of Jewish thought. The Pauline school, which is now the emergent Christianity, which says justification is by faith, and the historic Jewish school, which says justification is by the works of the law. That's how Luther read it. That's how Chrysostom read it. That's how Bauer read it. That's even how the New Perspective kinds of reads it, although it sees it in a subtly different way. But actually, if you listen to what Paul says, listen really carefully to what he says. He says, we who are Jews by birth and not sinful Gentiles know that a person is not justified by the works of the law. So his argument is, he says to Peter, says, we too are Jews. And so we share this realization that the way the God of Israel works is he doesn't justify people by the way they scratch his back or whether they find the right handshake or the right formula. And actually, Paul is even bolder as he goes on into chapter 3. He blows that out and says, that's a fundamental inheritance for every Jew. It goes all the way back to Abraham. Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. And so from the very beginning, every Jew, as they've heard their stories from their very earliest infancy, they've been told, you didn't get this because you were righteous. You got this because you had faith. God was gracious to you. He credited it to you as righteous. He didn't give it to you because you were righteous. And so Paul's point is, like, Jews have this, oh, they're human beings, right? All of us are human beings. And so Jews, just like every one of us, we're tempted to believe that we are the source of our right standing in God's sight. All of us are capable of that works righteousness move. But Paul actually wants to say, look, Jews, unlike every other nation on the earth, are actually well defended against that.
Yes.
It's a contrast. Because
their whole story from the very beginning is saying to them, no, that's not how God deals with you. Mm. But the point of Galatians 2:15 is that little parenthesis, we who are Jews by birth and not sinful Gentiles know. The point is, sinful Gentiles don't know that. They've not heard that. They don't have that protection. They've not heard that from their mother's knee. And so if you give them religious law, any kind of religious law, if it's pagan, if it's Jewish, it just doesn't matter, their natural reaction is going to be to think, this is the way to make myself right in the sight of God.
Yeah.
And so if you see once you've got that, it gives you, Zach, exactly what we've just said about everyone being right. Old perspective is right about what justification is. It's fundamentally about how you are, the estrangement between us and God is dealt with. It's dealt with from God's side. And that's why the issue is a salvation issue, why the warnings are so extreme. But the new perspective is right. Sanders was right, because this text is not telling us that Judaism is inherently legalistic. Actually, it's telling us exactly the opposite. Judaism is beautifully, singularly liberated from and defended from that perspective. And also it's telling us that the poor within Judaism crowd are right to this extent, that actually Paul can say this from a perspective of total integrity as a Jew. You don't have to believe that he's beating up on Judaism. You don't have to believe that his when he says, you've heard about my previous life in Judaism, that he's left it behind. Not at all. So this Paul that I'm opening up to you can circumcise Timothy with a good conscience, can accept synagogue discipline with a good conscience, without being radically incoherent. And so for me, it's been like the most exciting, kind of illuminating, lights going on moment. And suddenly the whole thing snaps into shape and you can see, I can see how all these pieces work together this way. And then maybe as we do a ride out, if we have time, I can say a little bit about why I think this is so relevant for now. But hopefully you can see there's a way here where all the different pieces actually kind of fit beautifully.
Phenomenal. Zach, I'm loving this. That was fantastic, Neil.
Isn't that good? Yeah.
I love it.
This is actually good. As I was listening to you, Neil, it's a contrast between paganism and the God of Israel. That's really what it is.
That's exactly.
And
beautiful.
You can think, and it is such a beautiful, really. If you can say it without, I don't mean this in a patronizing way, but in a Judaism vindicating way relative to the Book of Galatians.
Yes,
where it's all throughout Paul's. There's this kind of tension in Paul as you read him. Is he saying positive things about the law, or is he saying really negative things about the law? And that can be tough to sort out. But this is so helpful in sorting some of these things out. And it's a reframing, you know, you think about the pagans, the Gentiles being introduced to the God of Israel. And it's no, the Lord God of Israel is not like the gods that you grew up with. This God elected you. He chose you. He loves you. He's not capricious. He's not petty. He's not waiting for you to screw up so he can send a lightning storm against you. And it opens up all these really beautiful, rich biblical theological themes.
Wow. Pastorally, Neil, help us land the plane with kind of the most salient pastoral implications or applications of your thesis.
I mean, I think the first thing that really jumps out of this is I think that we assume that when someone becomes a Christian, that they're a tabula rasa, that it's just a new day, and that our task as ministers or our task as friends of people who have, you know, who are interested in Christian things is that we just need to think, right, what new book do I need to give them to read? What do I build on this new kind of virgin territory? Whereas Paul is just so much more thoughtful and psychologically aware than that. And basically in Galatia, he's alert to the fact that these guys have a past, and that even though I think he's fully paid up in his belief in radical transformation through through conversion, he talks about it in Galatians 3. He still realizes that what's going on under the surface matters. And actually, I just think that in churches and in our interaction with people who are growing into faith, and for ourselves as well, we need to be really aware of this, that actually the norms that we've amassed within the culture that we walk in are going to attach themselves to our faith in Christ unless we work really, really hard to avoid it.
Yes.
And so
yes.
For me, this is where it begins to mesh with, if you're familiar with Jamie Smith's cultural liturgies work. I think it's really exciting to see what he's saying. He says, look, just consider the amount of time you spend immersed basically in a pagan world. That, you know, we don't worship Zeus and Artemis and all this kind of stuff, but basically our lives in the 21st century are recognizably first century lives in that we spend most of our time trying to figure out how to make the future give us what we think we deserve. We invest our money, we invest our effort in our social media profiles, we invest our effort in our physical fitness, our appearance, in all of these different things, in the belief that if we do it wisely, we will maximize the chances of blessing for the future and minimize the chances of being cursed. Right? Do you spot that familiar pagan instinct? And we are immersed in that 18 hours a day compared to how much time do we actually spend consciously immersed in the things of God and really thinking his thoughts, thinking from his you know, that we are creatures. He is the creator. He gets to say what blessing is. We don't say to him, here's the blessing I want, and here's what I'm going to do to make you give it to me. And so Jamie Smith's insight is to say, look, those things that we are immersed in are forming us. They're forming habits in us. And I think what Paul is doing in Galatians is saying, look, just be really, really careful that those habits aren't actually the thing which is populating your faith. So I think Paul is looking at a bunch of people here who can point to a conversion moment in the past, who, if you ask them, who are you devoted to in terms of your religious life, would say, absolutely, Jesus of Nazareth, the Messiah of the Jews. And yet under the surface, he isn't concerned enough to say, I fear for you that somehow I've wasted my efforts on you, that you may not be Christians at all. And I think Paul is just saying that to 21st century evangelicalism. And he's saying, you have a great conversion experience you can point to. You have, you know, if someone scratched you on the surface or put it on a survey to say, you know, where's your religious allegiance? You would say Jesus of Nazareth, the, you know, the Messiah of the Jews. But are we not actually the way that we think about our entire religious life? Is it not actually shaped much more by our experience at the mall, our experience, you know, trying to make contributions to a bank account or something? Is that much more telling us how the world works? And does that inform our Christianity more? So I just think that there's a massive challenge for us here. I think Paul is actually asking us, you know, you look at Galatians superficially, and as I used to do, you just think, okay, well, I'm not tempted to get circumcised, so this has got nothing to say to me. But actually, as soon as you've seen that the foil for Paul's justification language is the entire infrastructure of pagan thought, basically what he's saying is that every single part of that worldly set of assumptions must fall before the claims of the God of Israel on your life. You know, you've got to be willing to accept that submissive posture, and every single part of you has got to be kind of transformed by the Spirit to be orientated towards him. So I just, wow, what a challenge. I mean, I don't think any of us are equal to that, but it's suddenly, I mean, this thing is just crying out to be preached on. It's crying out to be contextual.
Yes.
And I'm really, really enjoying engaging with, you know, friends in ministry and beginning to do that work of teaching on this and saying, what does it look like actually in our church? What does it look like in my own life situation?
That's fantastic, Neil. That is fantastic. And I hope an encouragement to folks that are thinking about doing, whatever they're working on now in terms of sort of theological, we have a lot of students that listen to the podcast, but this is just so inspiring and promising to hear the fruit on the back end of deep, serious, scholarly reflection, the kind of the theologian work for the pastoral office and vocation and calling. It's just a beautiful, beautiful picture of how it can operate at its best. So thank you for being on the podcast this morning. Thank you for everything you're doing and your partnership with us. This was tremendously encouraging, Neil.
Thanks, Neil.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the CPT Podcast, a theology podcast for the church. If you appreciated this episode, could I ask you to consider sharing it online with others, rating the show on Apple Podcasts, or even leaving a review? It means a lot to us, and it helps others hear about the show. The CPT Podcast is a production of the Center for Pastor Theologians. You can learn more about the CPT by visiting us at pastortheologians.com. You can also find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. The host for today's episode was Todd Wilson. Our producer and editor is Trenton Jones. Our music was composed by Andrew Gerlicher. I'm Zach Wagner. Thanks for listening.